to Office Hours, a social science podcast produced at the University of Minnesota, featuring conversations with prominent scholars, researchers, and other movers and shakers in the social world.
Corey Shdema is the author of Negotiating Justice, Progressive Lawyering, Low-Income Clients, and the Quest for Social Change. In this book, Dr. Shdema examines how the themes central to progressive lawyering, which are autonomy, collaboration, transformation, and social change, actually look on the ground in the legal services office. We discuss the ethnographic methods she used for this research and, in her perspective, how lawyers and clients navigate their relationships with one another. So the book itself is broken into sort of these, each chapter kind of has its own theme. After you introduce the history, and I really was struck by, I've worked at a few nonprofits myself, and how well you were able to hone in on this, you know, progressive social change mission, while the reality of, you know, what you call the necessity to get one's hands dirty. But leading up to these themes and that sort of, you know, overarching conclusion, you give a nice history of how this kind of lawyering came to be, and could you just inform our listeners briefly on where this came from, where this mission came from?
So in about, you know, the mid-1960s, I would say very much informed, you know, by various, you know, social justice movements for racial justice, for, you know, gender equality, coming out of law schools and coming often from law students, were real questions about the role of the legal system in either keeping people down or reinforcing the status quo, or as a potential for change, right? Could this be a vehicle for change? You know, and what should lawyers' roles be? At the same time, there was also a lot of discussion, as there continues to be today, about unmet legal needs, right? We have a lot of people who, you know, have legal needs, they have rights that they're unable to enforce. And these, you know, to some extent, kind of converged. There had always been, you know, what used to be called legal aid, and some people still call it legal aid, right? So there had always been legal aid programs, but most of the legal aid programs were about, you know, sort of addressed individual concerns, right? So if someone needs a divorce, or, you know, but concerns that really in helping people with these concerns weren't changing anything about systems,
yeah,
right? And so what happened is these kinds of legal programs started thinking, well, what if we challenge the welfare office, you know, mm-hmm. which was actually, you know, what if we challenge government bureaucracies and the way they treat people rather than just help people with their day-to-day needs, so that there could be an element to social change and that law could be used as a vehicle for social change. And that's where this really came from. And, you know, at the same time, there were changes that were being made in the federal government, through the Office of Economic Opportunity, which in the end, you know, helped to start the and funding for the Legal Services Corporation. I guess in other areas, there were concepts that were coming in. So there was a concept of maximum feasible participation. So the idea is that people should participate in directing, you know, where money is used and how agencies serve them, right? That was also coming into play. And so people were saying, these are our needs and this is what we're unhappy with. It's not just what you're giving services for. This was also, I think, something that informed this, you know, this process of change. Mm-hmm. And the federal government was coming in a lot of places, and through this money and through their requirements of maximum feasible participation was in some ways fueling, so you had federal money coming in that was fueling people to challenge their local and state governments, right? Yeah. Now, that didn't last very long for obvious
reasons,
right? You know, but there was a sort of a moment there, and the legal services programs, to some extent, grew in that moment. Now, NELS had actually formed before that, right? So it wasn't all about the money coming in from the Legal Services Corporation. NELS had formed even before that, right? So they were part of those people, because that actually had to go through the American Bar Association. It was a little more complicated, and I talk more about that in the book. But what happened is, you know, and so they even wanted to stop calling themselves, they didn't want to call themselves legal aid, because legal aid were the people that just, you know, help people with small things and would not take cases that would challenge government institutions or would challenge the status quo. So, you know, even the idea of going from legal aid to legal services, right, was a way to signal, no, we're different from these organizations.
And you sort of embed this history into these frameworks of the emergence of legal realism and what you also call cause lawyering. Can you explain that a bit?
You know, legal realism kind of came as a reaction to the way we used to study law, right? So law used to be said, well, this is what the books say, or this is what the cases say. But that doesn't really tell us anything about law in action, how law is used. So what actually happened when someone, you know, knocks on your door and takes your child away? That would be law in action, right? Someone is in the force of law, you know, and we weren't paying any attention to that. We were just saying, okay, this is what it says. And so the legal realism, you know, to some extent called for scholarship that said, okay, let's actually look and see what law does as a tool.
Yeah.
Or how law is actually used by people who are using it. Whether it's, you know, individuals who are trying to fight with their neighbors, or whether it's the state, you know, trying to enforce norms of behavior. But we need to pay attention to that, and all of that is part of law. It's not the laws or the cases that are part of laws. And so that, you know, that is what we, you know, need to be looking at as well. Right, so to some extent, right, so the idea is that we could actually use law for purposes, right, that law could be useful for purposes, but we also needed to ask questions then. I mean, if you sort of turned it back on itself, you could say, well, you know, even that we need to look at as social scientists. How does this happen? Why does this happen? You know, who's doing it? So, I mean, the cause lawyering has been around. Cause lawyering is a term that was coined by Austin Sarrett and Stu Sheingold, who are two of, well, Stu Sheingold passed away about a year ago, which is very sad. So they're two of my mentors and were very warm and welcoming when I first started becoming involved in the Law and Society Association, which is, I guess, sort of my intellectual home.
Okay.
They were trying to describe, and there have been arguments about how capacious this definition should be. So I don't want to go into, I don't think it's, you know, relevant for all of your audience, although some people, I find it interesting.
Right.
And so do a lot of others. But it's the idea that cause lawyering will encompass people who are using the law for something, for some other goal, right? So they're not so interested necessarily in the legal system, but for whom the goals are more important than the means. So, for example, and this is a good way of looking at my lawyer, I call them my lawyers. So my lawyers, you know, most of them actually became lawyers, not because they're like, I really want to be a lawyer, and then they said, well, what should I do? Mm-hmm. Most of them were like, I really want to, you know, work for social change, or I really want to work with people who have disabilities. You know, how can I use my skills best?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not good at math, I wouldn't be a good doctor, I'll be a lawyer. You know, but so it was more like they had some other goal in mind, and they tried to see how their aptitudes and skills could be channeled in a way that they could serve their goal, right? But so they're using the law in some ways as a tool to do something else for the cause that they have embraced. At some point in time in the cause lawyering history, there's a great book that was written by Austin and Stu that charts this history.
Mm-hmm.
There are a number of 5 edited volumes also that are really helpful. I have pieces in 3 of them from this same research, you know. But so, for example, you know, it was broader than just looking at, let's say, left activist lawyers, right? So a lot of times we think of legal services lawyers. We're thinking about lawyers from the left who are using it, or let's say, you know, whether it's Roe v. Wade, you know, that kind of case, or whether it's these lawyers that I'm talking about. But you could use cause lawyering, actually, to look at right-wing, and people have done this, right-wing cause lawyers.
Oh, right. Okay.
Right. So it sort of opens up for a way of thinking intellectually about this idea of using law for some other extrinsic goal, and for something that means a lot to you. It's not, and the goal wouldn't just be to make money, right?
Right. Because there are ways to do that, too, if you really need to as a lawyer.
But to use it for some cause. And when we say a cause, we mean some sort of perceived social good. We might disagree about, we might have different visions of the social good, but this idea is that we're using law for some sort of other cause or purpose that is outside of the law.
Mm-hmm.
and that is meaningful, you know, that has sort of a value to us.
As a social scientist, like you said, looking at, you know, how that process works towards these sort of desired outcomes, you bring up how to theorize power into this. And you said when we were discussing methods, you know, power is something you can't directly ask about. But how did you think about power, and how did you want to explore power? And did, you know, was it more between client lawyer power or client society power? Was it everything? I mean, it's just sort of, it's such a large, broad concept. How did you fit it in?
It is. And I can actually connect it to the cause lawyering, right? Like, why does it matter that we think about lawyers as cause lawyers, you know? And part of that is because if you have some other goal, right, that you can imagine that there might be a conflict between the means and the goal.
Yeah.
And power, for example, was one of those imagined conflicts, right? So if you have lawyers who are legal services lawyers who ascribe most of them, right, to a certain value set. So most of them are lawyers because they care about social justice. A lot of them, the reasons that they're involved in lawyers is because they want to empower disempowered people, right? And so what happens when you have is if that's your goal, if the lawyer-client relationship itself can be disempowering, mm-hmm. then means that you're using conflicts with your goal. And so because this goal is more important than your lawyering, then you'll say, well, should I really be a lawyer? Right? And mm-hmm. so that's really the tie between thinking about these lawyers as cause lawyers, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, who are troubled a lot of times about the way that they lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the literature that I read, you know, that talked a lot about this idea that you know, it's dangerous actually to lawyer, you know, for poor people if you have as a goal empowerment. And a lot of it did focus on power. And so the lawyers themselves were often troubled, you know, maybe I'm working against my own goals if what I'm doing in this relationship is I'm, you know, telling somebody that I get to make all the decisions and they don't know what they're talking about, or that they get some sense that they don't have a role. And so I was particularly interested in power because it comes up so much in what troubles people about this conflict between, you know, the goals and the methods.
There's lots of parts in the book where this comes up of how there is the critique that what is called incremental work, or, you know, sort of the bread and butter legal issues, is dangerous, in part because, you know, the broader goals can't be reached in some ways, or you can't work towards them in a direct way because you're, you know, working with clients day to day. But also that power is just so embedded in that. And how did your lawyers reconcile that bread and butter legal issues balance, or the routine work versus the systemic change work?
My idea is, like, you know, there's power, there's big power kind of out there, but I'm very interested in this idea, like Foucault's idea of where power happens at all these little spaces,
yeah.
and it's current that flows through relationships. And so, but what I was sort of interested in, I went in thinking about, I was going to look at power and conflict between the lawyer and the client, because that's where most of the literature sent me. And I out of the research, and I think that, you know, almost all of my chapters are infused with this, right? It sets up all the chapters, including the question that you just asked, mm-hmm. is that actually when we focus too much on the potential for the lawyer-client relationship to disempower, we're forgetting about, you know, the power dynamics between the clients and the outside institutions that they're enlisting these lawyers to help them with.
Right.
And we should pay attention if we're going to look at the value of legal services practice, or if we're going to figure out how should we engage in legal services practice, we can't just look at these separately, mm-hmm. right? Because if we do, then we might portion the potential for disempowerment or the danger for disempowerment if we don't take into consideration the idea that lawyers and clients together can work, you know, in their power relationship with these outside institutions.
Yeah, it's just, it's that the embeddedness of power is at all these levels that it's perhaps more helpful to conceptualize instead of just these in-the-office power dynamic moments.
Well, and also if we only focus on the in-the-office power dynamic moments that are there, right,
yeah.
we might ignore the larger problems, which is, you know, which are, you know, the welfare office or the contractor or the person that gave you the predatory loan, when they're
right.
much more harmful. And so to some extent, I don't want to say that they're a red herring because I think they're important. I don't want in any way for the book to be thought of as, you know, coming against these very important critiques, because I think that people who care about the way they treat other people should pay attention to this. So it's not about that. But I think if we overdo that and then we forget about the people that they're working together, the lawyers and clients are working together to fight, we do a disservice because it's sort of out of a context and then we're blowing out of proportion, you know, the power dynamic here by ignoring it there.
Yeah, and it also kind of ignores the reason that someone becomes a Nell's client in the first place.
Exactly.
So that's like, and this is in some, for a lot of people, probably the end or nearing the end of a very long, I mean, you open the book with the story of that man and his wife who for years and years were having problems with the mortgage company until they got to Nell's and they finally got help. So
he's probably still having problems. He was having problems even after he got help.
Yeah, and I think that's something that's really valuable and helpful in your book is that you do situate it in the beginning as, you know, here is where the literature is and these are key elements and here's some of the history, but sort of broadening it into this, into how power is operating at these different levels. And you kind of start this chapter 3, which is called Law and Social Change, on how the lawyers themselves sort of work through these competing goals. And maybe you could just speak to that a bit. I know you call it like the bread and butter, the incremental work.
Right. Okay. So sometimes people tend to, again, in the literature and even, you know, when we're thinking of, even personally, I think when you think what's the kind of work that I do, you know, some people tend to think of or differentiate between the day-to-day practice of direct representation. Client comes into my office, they have ongoing legal issues, they're having problems with the banks, with their lenders, with the welfare office, with the, you know, with their Social Security disability insurance benefits, whatever it is, you know, and they would juxtapose that against sort of boutique cases like class action lawsuits or, you know, broad scale social change largely that used to happen. I think it happens more broadly now. I don't want to overgeneralize, but that people think of as happening kind of at the Supreme Court level kind of social change.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think that people who do one might, you know, have different skills than people who do other, who do the other. And because there were such limited resources in legal services program, you know, very often programs have to decide, well, am I going to be doing this or that? And I can't really be doing both because they do require different resources and they do require, you know, different kinds of thinking and they have different time trajectories and all that stuff. But I do think that that's sort of a false dichotomy. And the one thing that I loved about Nell's is it's a legal services program that actually does do both. Now, sometimes the same people do both, mm-hmm. but a lot of times the people do it's not, but they all work together and their work informs each other. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really helpful. And I do write some more about that in the book, the ways that I think that's helpful. But the bread and butter legal issues, you know, this sort of very routine work, a lot of people find it not so glamorous. You'll see, you know, there are all sorts of articles coming out over the past 10 years about new forms of lawyering for the poor. You know, small business lawyer is one of the ones that has been written about a lot. And I think that those are really important, but, you know, and they tend to, but I did get some reaction on the book. Early on, not from very many people, said, oh, this is a throwback. This is 60s lawyering, you know, that kind of thing. And my reaction to that is, yes, I think we need to innovate, and I do think we need to think about a lot of things, but I'm not telling, but can we really say to somebody who said, you know, my child has just been removed from my home, you know, can I really want help. You really want to say to them, well, we're not doing that anymore in legal services.
Right.
You know, problems don't go away, you know, just because we found other innovative things to do. And so so I think that all of these, to the extent they can, need to exist side by side. But people have very, very basic needs that they need to have met. And I think to ignore them, to leave them high and dry just because we're moving to a different perception of, you know, what's the best way to be doing lawyering, I think is kind of cruel.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing that these lawyers, because people come into the office on a day-to-day basis, it's also, the lawyers I spoke to at least, it's very hard to ignore these needs when people tell them, this is what's happening in my life. And if you're you know, even minorly empathetic, it's hard to ignore that this really is a problem, and we should be addressing this problem.
Right.
And we don't, nobody else is going to address this problem. And so that's what I'm thinking about the bread and butter legal issues, these very basic things that happen again and again and again. And even when there's social change, and even when there's a big ruling at the welfare office, you're still going to have people coming again and again with similar questions. And it's not glamorous, but it's necessary.
And you do write that the two approaches really can be complementary, because the two activities really inform one another. It makes systemic work real and tangible in a way, and more informed. And then it sort of adds the inspiration and mission that you need to sustain the day-to-day technical work.
Exactly. And I heard both of those, you know, both in terms of the sustenance, you know, so I had one lawyer, she herself doesn't do class action lawsuits, and she does disability benefits for children. And she said to me, you know, that's what I do. She said, but if I didn't know that there was someone in my office fighting that big fight out there, I don't know if I could do this on a day-to-day basis.
Right.
She really needed to know that from a morale perspective. And then there's the very practical perspective, almost if you think of NELS as like a hub on a wheel, right? People come in and they learn about things. And so, for example, you know, the lawyers from the consumer unit, they would have people come in and they didn't realize there was a big problem. And all of a sudden, people would come in and more people. And it was around, they learned about these loan scams around Pell Grants. So would people come up to people in the welfare office and they'd put, you know, a white coat on them and said, oh, you look fantastic. They get people to take out loans and they couldn't really complete the programs. And you know, and so, but they learned about this. They were taking it first individual cases, but then it turned out that this was a very large problem in Northeast City. And then they were then trying to think about addressing it systemically.
Mm-hmm.
Know about either the existence or the prevalence of the problem, you know, it was these day-to-day individual cases coming in, and then they're like, all of a sudden, wait a second.
Yeah.
We have 200 of these cases. Okay. This is, then they start taking it to systemic. So that's more of a strategic than a morale reason for having it. But for both of those reasons, I think they're really important.
And how, for those lawyers that were honest with you on their frustration that can also come out of trying to balance these, I know you talk about Pete from the public benefits unit, and he was just sort of, you know, the frustrations inherent in these two activities. But when you describe Pete's frustration, you also talk about this idea of realistic radicalism, and I never heard that before. So could you kind of explain how that fits into the stories you were hearing?
Well, you have to first think about the word radical, right? So the word radical comes from, you know, root, and so the idea, if something is radical, that means that you're changing something from the root. You want to make something different, okay?
Mm-hmm.
It comes from this idea that a lot of the lawyers at NELS, and frankly a lot of the clients, I don't know that they would say it explicitly, but they really would like to see radical change, okay? They think that the systems that they work in are unfair, that they're hostile to poor people, and really what they would like to do is they'd like to have a different system entirely, okay? And that would be, you know, if they were going to be engaged in radical practice. However, you know, if you look at our existing system, and this is, there's some great quote from one of my lawyers in here where he said, you know, if I thought there was going to be a revolution, I wouldn't be lawyering.
Yeah, right.
I'd be out there on the picket line.
Yeah.
And so that's the dilemma for at least these lawyers, okay? And you know, if there would be some sort of a radical revolution, they'd be there, okay?
Of course. Mm-hmm.
But they don't really believe that there's going to be one. And, you know, they didn't say this, but I would say this. I would say it's the same thing I said about the bread and butter legal, to say, excuse me, I'm not going to help you today, challenge your denial of benefits because I'm waiting for the revolution. Or let's go work on the revolution, you know, and by the time that happens, you're gone, you know.
Yep.
And so it also comes from a place of deep compassion, right? I don't want people to suffer. And so what's my choice? My choice is working within the system, okay? And if I work within the legal system, right, so if I bring an appeal to the welfare office, I have to follow their rules.
Yep.
And so I'm not challenging their authority. And so to that extent that I'm using the system and I'm complying with it, I am accepting the rules, and so I am helping to continue the status quo.
Right.
And so then there's this idea of, well, so what does that mean for me? How can this not be disheartening? How can this not eventually make me either want to leave or make me forget about my radical aspirations in the first place when I really want to hold on to them and I really still believe in them?
Yeah.
The question then comes to be, can you actually engage in action that has a radical orientation but isn't a radical action?
Mm-hmm.
So looking from the outside, okay, if you were looking from the outside at Pete's work in the welfare office for his clients, you wouldn't be able to distinguish him from a non-radical person, right? If you just look from the outside. So I started asking, well, does that matter? So in other words, so people do it anyway, even if they're radical, because, like, this is what's realistic, and this is what I can do for now, okay? And there's a little piece of the Piven Clower, you know, overwhelm the system thing, too, in there. So maybe if I do enough of it, then the system will be overwhelmed and it will change, right? So I'm still radical, but I'm also realistic. So that means I'm not co-opting to the system. I don't really want to reinforce the status quo. So that's why I'm calling it realistic radicalism. And my question was really like, so what? Or does this distinction make a difference? And my conclusion in the book is it really does matter. Mm. And it matters most, I think, to clients. Mm-hmm. You turn, and when Pete turns and he says to Marianne, you know, I agree, go demonstrate at the Olympics, or whatever he says, you know, this system is terrible and it's treating you unfairly, he's trying to reinforce their mutual political understanding. He's trying to say to her, this is not you, this is the system. And it's a message that's very different than the message that those clients are getting from other people. It also helps to validate what the clients themselves are thinking, right? You know, by more political. And so I think it makes a very big difference to the clients when, even though from the outside, this realistic radicalism wouldn't look like it's radical. Mm-hmm. And I think that's very, very important. And I also think it helps the lawyers. I mean, you know, and then you have the question of, well, how do you end up not making that eventually become some sort of a rationalization? And that's where the lawyers are really challenged, and they have to think about, well, what are the opportunities? When can I snipe at the system? And, you know, to what extent can I keep this belief and my understanding alive? And, you know, and so that's hard. That's hard to do on a day-to-day basis, and they have places where they can do it. So one thing could be through these, you know, larger systems changes that they try to do or hook up with. Mm-hmm. And so these conversations then become important, not just for the clients, ensuring some, you know, in terms of shoring up some sense that this is really actually wrong. You know, it's not just me, but this is wrong. But it becomes crucial to the lawyers, because the client's reinforcement of the lawyers helps the lawyers go on. And I think we're very much, we think about legal services lawyers and transformation, we think a lot about, oh, isn't it nice, the lawyers are, truth is the clients are also really helping the lawyers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's sort of this mutual reinforcement that kind of gets you through the day, but also gets you through to the bigger things, the loftier goals.
Well, and it helps keep your work meaningful. And these are people for whom it matters a lot that they have a job that's meaningful, you know. You know, and so it does make a huge difference, I think, to the lawyers. And I think we overlook the contribution that clients give to the lawyers. Not that I don't know that the lawyers overlook that. I ask them that, you know, they I have quotes where they show me. But I think we ignore that a little bit too much.
Yeah, that's interesting. The next three parts of the book, you sort of frame through these kind of values or tenets of progressive lawyering, and to sort of explore how they actually play out in the real world as opposed to just being, you know, abstract concepts. So you talk about autonomy, collaboration, and interaction.
Yes.
And I'd like, if you have a bit more time, I'd like to just walk through those three chapters a bit. Sure. And just starting with autonomy, because, again, that was something I hadn't really thought about. But first of all, having client autonomy, having clients make their own decisions and be an active partner in the solution, assumes that they're ready to make those decisions, they're fully informed. How did your lawyers sort of navigate that goal?
I think I say in the beginning that they have these sort of really amorphous understandings of autonomy, and it really comes from a place of respect for dignity, you know, and decision-making capacities. And it also comes from this idea, you know, of lawyering, right? I mean, and that's where, I mean, my lawyers would probably say they're very different than other kinds of lawyers, but that's something that they share as lawyers, right? This idea that your client is really supposed to decide where your representation is supposed to go. Mm-hmm. And so that's something that I think also when we're socialized, we, all of us, myself included, are socialized as lawyers, you know, you think about that. You are supposed to represent your client. And so to that extent, the idea of client direction of the representation is something that is probably broader than just among this particular group. It's also something that's talked a lot about in the progressive lawyering literature. But I think you're right. I mean, I think there's a whole bunch of different issues that come up. I mean, one of them, and I think it's Dara, there's a client there who said, you know, I don't hunt, I don't fish. You know, when I get a legal issue, I'm not handling this on my own.
Right, right.
And there's a whole client narrative, what I call, you know, sort of the cautionary tale narrative, mm-hmm. you know, it says, you know, if you have a legal problem, you not only like is it an abdication of your autonomy to go to is it not an abdication of your autonomy to go to a lawyer, you're not doing your job if you don't go, right? So I have one client, I can't remember now where the quote is, I have one client who says she said I told my neighbor, you know, it was her neighbor, her cousin, I told her to go, and then when the man came knocking on her door and was, you know, calling her out of her house, you know, I was like, don't blame me, I told you to get legal help.
Yeah.
Right? So there's this cautionary tale where it's really your responsibility to find competent help. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing that we would, you know, if you think you're middle class or upper class clients, well, you know, you're not telling somebody to handle all of their own transactions on their own. When it's a legal transaction, you get a lawyer.
Right.
So, you know, so I think that a lot of times when we think about autonomy, you know, it oftentimes is a narrow understanding of autonomy. What I was trying to look for my interviews is thinking about autonomy more broadly. Like, if you think about the context of clients' lives, right, taking a problem and handing it off to legal services actually allows them to enhance their autonomy more generally because it allows them to deal with all the other things that they're dealing with at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that what's interesting is I find that a lot of the lawyers were sort of troubled, you know, when, you know, where's the line? You know, how much do I take on for a client? And when do I say to a client, that's not a legal issue?
Yeah.
Or that's you can handle on your own. And I found that not so much that I struggled, but the lawyers themselves were troubled with how to figure this out. And I found it really interesting that they were so troubled by it, because it seemed to me when they would explain these situations where it come up, it seemed pretty clear to me that you know, they were making these decisions based on the context. You know, what else was going on in this client's life? You know, how overwhelmed were they? It seemed like they were using compassion, you know, professional expertise as a way to gauge how much to do and how much to ask clients to do, but they weren't recognizing these other values that were coming into play. Perhaps we're not socialized, or we don't talk about them in law school, and perhaps because we don't talk about them enough in you know, sort of the progressive literature. But I found that really, really interesting. And I also found that the clients thought they were being much more autonomous than the lawyers, like, who worried about that.
Right. So it's maybe part of it is just this almost oversensitivity to the issue on behalf of the lawyers, just that they're so cognizant of it that because of their specific type of lawyering.
Right. And sometimes, in fairness to the lawyers, they didn't know. Like, I remember, like, the woman who I was speaking to, Dara, the one about the I don't fish, I don't hunt kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
you know, she had so much going on in her life, even more than her lawyer knew. So she was taking care of two children of a friend who had died and her own children. And I mean, she had a lot of stuff, and the lawyer didn't necessarily know all those things, and the lawyer wouldn't have to know. But I, you know, clients often have a lot of things going on in their lives, and it's not just low income clients. All of us do, right? Even when I've had the opportunity to be on the other end of this some community thing I was working on. And so, you know, I mean, I think that if we think about, I had one lawyer, who said this, actually, you know, he said, I know clients have a million other things. It's just, I don't see them. When they come into the office, this is what I see, because this is what they're talking to me about.
Right. Yes. Do you think that that's for your lawyers, was that a problem for some of them, putting limits on, it's almost what you call the retainer model, or these personal relationships?
Yeah, I mean, they definitely talked about that, and some people had more problems than others. I mean, the whole idea of setting boundaries came up in a lot of different ways. Yeah, I mean, on the one hand, they said, you know, they kind of liked the idea of the retainer model. The client who raised the best example, she wanted to be like, with her lawyer the way, like, they were on Dallas. you know, kind of like they come to their family functions and they all hang out together. And whenever she has a problem, she'll be like, hello, you know, call her lawyer. And she was interesting. She said now when she walks into the welfare office, when she has a problem, she doesn't even need to actually call. She just says, I'm going to call my lawyer. And then they cooperate with her. So, you know, clients are really savvy on that as well. But so I think that, you know, there is some understanding of the benefit of having this, you know, this retainer model, that when you run into problems, you can call a lawyer and things get solved a lot more easily, whether it's because the lawyer has expertise or because even if you know what you're talking about, they're not listening to you. But when the lawyer gets on the phone, they're a lawyer and they'll listen to you.
Yeah.
On the other hand, the retainer model just really probably does not work for legal services programs for the most part because of this resource issue. So I think they do struggle with that. And you know, sometimes they'll say, I can't help you with this. A lot of them do referrals to other places.
Oh, okay.
So that's one way they manage it. And, you know, another way they manage is that they don't take everybody as a client, you know, so there is some sort of a screening at the client level.
I mean, it's funny, these different slices of work or, you know, sort of aspects of the job seem to continually reflect again that, like, the balance between client and person versus, I'm a lawyer with limited time, but I'm still a person and I have compassion, but that, you know, I'm trying to work for change and I'm trying to help you get through the day. It's just, it seems like there's a constant negotiation on behalf of these lawyers almost every day of how to prioritize and how to maintain all at the same time.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good way of putting it. And that's the getting your hands dirty. Like, it's very easy to sit here and write an article telling them what to do, or for me to sit here and say, okay, this is what they do. Let me try and frame an understanding of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but when you're actually doing it, it's incredible that they actually are able to do it on a day-to-day basis. And the fact that I was able, even if they weren't so aware, that I was able to discern sort of a pattern and an ethic mm-hmm. to their, you know, to their process of doing it, because there is an ethic to it and there is a pattern, you know, I thought really where they can't see it because they're so enmeshed in this day to day.
Yeah. So more broadly, where do you situate these findings and this analysis, both sort of theoretically and sort of, you know, what are the implications or what are you hoping that the impact is? I mean, obviously a huge impact is on the field of progressive lawyering and really sort of explaining what these processes are. But beyond that, is there any other holes you're trying to fill or where you're situating this in terms of the broader field?
You know, I think it's really all about lawyers and clients who are trying to work together in a system that they both find pretty hostile, that both groups find pretty hostile, and find a way, it's again this realistic radicalism, find a way to make change that they can somehow live with or feel like they're trying to make a difference given the existing constraints. And that's a hard place to be. But I just really admire the people who continue, because the alternative to not doing that is often to give up.
Yeah.
Is either to become irrelevant. And I don't want to say that anyone who works for system change is irrelevant. I mean, I think that's really important. But I think that there always need to be people who are in it and in the fight. And that's where, again, this, you know, feminist ethic of risk comes. And you can say that for any individual who's trying to work in that framework, whether it's a person that we call a client because they're constructed as a client in that situation or a defendant or whatever they are, or the professionals who are trying to work with them, that I actually think that they're doing, you know, sort of the most ethical thing that they can do, because they're staying in there and they're trying to take the best course of action that they can while not becoming inured to the problems with the existing system.
Mm-hmm.
They're getting their hands dirty and they're being open to change and criticism. In order to, you know, not stop caring and not stop doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is in this book, and I think that's really the implications. And it could be whether you're a lawyer or whether you're, you know, a social worker or whether you're a teacher or anyone who cares about social change or whether you're a person who's sort of perpetually stuck in these systems, you know, and you're continuing to fight and not give up. And, you know, how do we help each other do that also, right? Because you're not doing this in a vacuum. I mean, that's one of the lessons here, right? How do the lawyers continue to do this? One thing they do is, you know, they talk to each other, that the people who you're trying to work for or with, that you talk to them, right? That you say, this is what I've done. What do you think?
Yeah.
You know, they help keep you honest. So if these lawyers close themselves off to input from clients, then you're no longer a realistic radical, you know. Mm-hmm. Or if you close yourself off to the idea that you can do harm, then you're no longer a realistic radical either. Mm-hmm. So it really is continuing to do while being open to the idea and being humble about the idea that we're definitely going to make mistakes.
Yeah.
And that we need to be open to changing that, and that that input needs to come from, and that's, you know, Sharon Welch's feminist ethic of risk that I found so perfect, you know, for this, you know, is we need to open ourselves up to community input, whatever that relevant community is,
yeah.
To keep ourselves honest.
That's all for Office Hours. Thanks for listening, as always. And thanks to the TSP team at Minnesota and the nice folks in the University of Minnesota College of Liberal Arts Office of Information Technology for hosting the societypages.org and these here MP3 files. See you soon!
I'm not going to